You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa. No mai hare mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Ezra. E whai ahine coming up on the show. For our regular catch-up with the ACT Party, I speak to MP Simon Court about the government's plan to address low truancy levels post-COVID-19 and Court's ex-post stating that he stands with Israel. I speak to professional teaching fellow in education and social work at the University of Auckland, Dr. Brian Marsh, and senior lecturer in education and social work at the University of Auckland, Dr. John Finotti, about how the government can improve school attendance rates. And I report on Trade Me's legal action against Trade Jobs NZ, speaking to owner of Trade Jobs NZ, Colleen Jetley. Ezra, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Associate Professor at the University of Waikato, David Campbell, and Senior Ecologist at Manukī Whenua, Olivia Birch, about the climate-saving potential of wetland conservation.
He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Wire Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō he pakihiri, roki roki maoranga, iti pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho. Mi haere kina D5BFM e rakati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on our website, 95bfm.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
For our weekly interview with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government's plan to increase student attendance rates post-COVID-19. As well as his post on X last week, in which he stated that he stands with Israel. Here is that interview. The government has announced a traffic light system to increase school attendance, with a target of ensuring 80% of students are present for more than 90% of the term by 2030. How does this plan differ from what measures are already in place to manage truancy?
Well, we're going to put in place immediate changes so that attendance data is published weekly. At the moment, it's reported quarterly, and under the previous government, what was happening, it wasn't being reported until the following quarter or even the one after that. So it was absolutely meaningless in trying to track whether children are attending school or not and what might be some of the correlations or causations if they weren't. So we're going to require publishing attendance data weekly. We're going to clarify attendance expectations for school boards, and we're going to roll out an awareness campaign about the importance of attending school, because almost every aspect of someone's adult life will be defined by education that they receive as a child. And so if we do want better social outcomes, we can't keep ignoring this truancy crisis. This government intends to create a culture where children know if they want to get anywhere in life, they do need to get to school first.
Part of the system will include fining parents. What will happen in the case of if a parent can't afford these fines?
Well, at a later date, I understand that Minister David Seymour will be bringing more proposals to Cabinet, which include mandating daily reporting of attendance data, not just weekly, and developing that traffic light system you mentioned to set out requirements for attendance, and setting out the clear obligations for when a student is not attending, what happens next. Now, whether this be fines or some other kind of sanction as an initial response is yet to be determined. If somebody can't pay a fine, then they're already a range of options available to courts around enforcement. I guess the point is, between now and 2030, we want to get 90% of kids attending school, 80% of students attending school for 90% of the time, because we think that's the measure that's going to ensure New Zealand's successful for decades and in the century to come.
How will you ensure that these penalties would be applied equitably, so in the case of a lower income family, that fine's going to have much more weight than perhaps a higher income family who would be willing to pay that fine to take their kids out of school for a one or 2 week long vacation every term?
Well, that's why this government's going to be setting expectations to school boards about attendance, you know, and clear obligations for when a student's not attending what schools and school boards are required to do. Taking children out of school for 2 week vacations simply because, you know, they're going to experience different things about the world is completely unacceptable. You know, I mean, you could make the same case for all of these children and young people attending climate protests that, you know, they're getting something out of life that they wouldn't get from being in the classroom. Well, this party, the ACT Party and this government absolutely disagrees with that. If there are families that are going to struggle to pay a fine, you know, they have an option. Get the kids to school. And if they can't get them to school and they need help, then get the help they need from the schools, from other community services and agencies that can help them. Because if those children and those families are not going to school, they're going to have much worse life outcomes than if they did go to school. And you know, this government wants to help them. And we don't want to fine them.
Speaking of help, do you have any plans to reduce barriers for students with disabilities or low-income students that prevent them from attending school?
Well, I'm not aware of any current policy proposals that directly target children from low-income families or children with disabilities, but I do know there is already a lot of support in place. I have a son with a disability, Down syndrome, who's been able to attend various schools over the years that meet his needs. And you know, there are significant programs in place already to support children and young people with special needs to attend school.
To move on, I also wanted to speak to you about your post on X last week where you said that you stand with Israel. ACT's coalition partners have called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Is this something that ACT supports?
Absolutely. Our foreign minister called on Hamas to release all the remaining hostages immediately, and that also Israel must do everything in its power to enable safe, rapid and unimpeded humanitarian access into and throughout Gaza. The problem is there can only be a ceasefire if both parties want it. Israel has been attempting to negotiate with Hamas for weeks now, and twice and now Hamas have walked away from the negotiating table, say they refuse to entertain the ceasefire that Israel and the international negotiators are offering. These people attacked Israel on October 7. They killed over 1,200 people. They killed hundreds at the Nova Music Festival. They treated young women brutally. They raped, they tortured, they've taken hundreds back into Gaza, and they refuse to negotiate a ceasefire.
So all right, but Simon, I'm going to interrupt you because a lot of those claims are unsubstantiated. And since then, 32,000 Palestinians have been killed. There's been thousands of Israelis protesting against Netanyahu's government, calling on them as well to do more to accept a ceasefire and ensure the release of Israeli captives. So do you support these calls coming from Israel's own citizens?
Absolutely. A ceasefire is absolutely vital. The people of Gaza cannot be safe until there is a ceasefire, safe from this conflict. But I also want to come back to what you said before, that the claims are unsubstantiated. These claims are videoed and documented by Hamas operatives themselves who wore body cameras and filmed themselves carrying out these acts at places like the Nova Music Festival. They were filmed taking the dead bodies of abused young people back into Gaza. They are all over social media. There's also been significant documentary evidence, including even provided by the UN, which substantiates what I've said. So these are not claims. This is fact. Israel is dealing with an existential threat right now. not just from Hamas, but also from Iranian proxies across the region, and this weekend from Iran itself, which fired over 200 ballistic missiles and dozens of drones towards Israel, some of which got through the defensive system.
Yeah, so there has been reports from the UN have said that there is evidence to suggest that violence could have occurred, but at this time it is not confirmed. But that's what the UN report has said, that there is grounds to believe that violence could have occurred. But I do want to go back to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Are you concerned that Israel has indicated it will be launching a military offensive into Rafah?
Well, Israel's in the most unenviable positions when it faces these awful trade-offs. They have to continue to defend themselves from the existential threat posed by these Hamas terrorists. Hamas has said publicly and repeatedly they would commit October 7 again. Israel needs to also avoid the risk to innocent civilians in an area under terrorist rule in a way that in many cases is impossible to reconcile with the need to actually recover the hostages Hamas has got and try to eliminate Hamas as a terrorist organisation.
Okay, so I just want to clarify then. So you don't support a ceasefire? You don't support an immediate ceasefire, I should say. You support a ceasefire perhaps long term, but not an immediate one.
Well, let's be clear. If Israel puts down its guns and walks away, what's going to happen? The terrorists win, and they will continue to hold their weapons. It's very important that the people of Israel and the people of the surrounding countries like Jordan and Egypt can be confident that Hamas is suppressed, if not completely disarmed and disestablished as an organisation, so that they no longer keep those 2.5 million people in Gaza under the control of a terrorist dictatorship. Mm. This is not Israel's problem to solve alone. The awful problem is that Hamas is hiding behind the millions of civilians in places like Al-Shifa Hospital in Rafah. And, you know, I'm not a military strategist. My post that you questioned around why I stand with Israel is because Israel is a small democracy. It's the only place in the Middle East where being gay is okay.
Okay, but do you also stand with those Palestinian civilians, Simon?
Jess, if you mind, I'll just finish. I think it's really important that New Zealand looks at those nations where we would say they are like us and we share their values and they are under attack.
But there's many members of the Jewish community here in New Zealand and Aotearoa, because in your statement you said that you stand with Israel and the Jewish community, and those aren't necessarily the same thing. There is plenty of Jewish-led organisations here in Aotearoa and around the world who do not support the Israeli government's actions. So there are lots of people that have questioned your statement. So I just want to clarify, do you stand with those members of the Jewish community as well who are against the Israeli government's actions? And do you stand with the Palestinian civilians who are being killed as a result of the Israeli government's actions in Gaza?
Let's be clear. I don't advocate for the actions of any other foreign government. But the Israeli government has to defend its people and try and get its hostages back. I absolutely accept that there are thousands of people in Gaza right now who are in harm's way, who are in the middle of a
They're dead, Simon. They're dead. There's 32,000 people that have died, a majority of them being children.
It's awful. It's awful that civilians have been killed in that conflict. You must consider who started the conflict and who has the ability to end it. When Israel is at the negotiating table in Qatar, which they have been for the past couple of weeks, and Hamas continues to walk away, you have to ask yourself, we can call here in New Zealand for a ceasefire now. I support the call for an immediate ceasefire. But the problem is, the other side doesn't. And so you can't have one side having a ceasefire. And I think that's essentially where I say, I stand with Israel. Because if Israel, the people of Israel, you know, not their government, not their political parties, but the people of Israel, people like us, who just want to go to a rave, who want to go to the beach, who want to be able to go about their lives, and the Palestinian people also, who want the same things, all those people.
Yeah, I guess I just don't understand, Simon, why you can't just say, I stand with the Palestinian civilians, because it seems like you don't.
Well, I certainly appreciate the terrible situation that they're in. But I want to make it absolutely clear. The reason that my post And the reason I do stand with Israel and the reason I attend vigils for the hostages is because there are people in the Jewish community in New Zealand who are saying that the level of anti-Semitic attacks and violence, including on Jewish kids at school, is out of control.
Yes, but can't you condemn anti-Semitism while also acknowledging that the Israeli government has gone beyond a point necessary?
Well, as I pointed out, they're in the most unenviable of positions, and I can't assume I have the same knowledge they do when they're making their decisions about what actions they take.
All right.
I'll tell you, the reason I stand with Israel is because small, vulnerable democracies like New Zealand, like Israel, need to stick together. We need to recognise that if it wasn't for countries like the United States, like Great Britain, and like Israel's neighbours, Egypt and Jordan, Israel would have been wiped out by people like Hamas years ago. And, you know, it's important that we recognise that in New Zealand. And we stand with the people who would otherwise be eliminated, and that is the Israelis right now.
You could argue that's the Palestinians as well, but that's all the time we have for now, Simon.
Thank you, Jess. All the best. I hope your listeners get something out of that.
That was ACT MP Simon Court on truancy as well as ACT's pro-Israel stance.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
RIP Mittens. She's gone. At least I have these photos to remember her. Look, her first steps.
Aww.
Eating her first bird.
Ew.
And her last moment. I call this one raspberry jelly.
Ugh, why? What?
Damn that car.
What is that shining in the gutter?
Her beautiful angelic eye.
Pro Gear Photographic. For photos that'll bring out the light in your eyes, no matter the circumstance. Head to Pro Gear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Hot off the press, Motet's Live Day Printing is back. Sunday, April 21, 10 a.m. till 4 p.m.
Get inspired with printing of all types, including sun printing, 3D printing, t-shirt printing, printing experiments, and more. Don't forget a t-shirt.
Motet's Live Day Printing, included in general admission. Sunday, April 21, 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. Find out more at motet.nz.
Record Store Day at Southbound Records is back for 2024, this Saturday. Seasons turn,
we stick together. Moved out to a new city.
10% off store-wide Record Store Day exclusive releases and a chance to win a Riga Planner 1 turntable. In-store only, this Saturday, 9 a.m. at Southbound Records.
Mr. Blasto and Mr. Partridge.
1, 2, 3.
Let 95BFM take the wheel of your weekend with Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside with Princess Chelsea and Marlon's Dreaming. Friday, 26 April from 4 to 7 p.m.
Cruise on down to the Beer Spot. Grab yourself a 95BFM lager available on tap and enjoy the royally good tunes of Princess Chelsea and Marlon's Dreaming with Friday's Drive host Anika.
Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside, Friday, 26th of April, from 4 to 7 p.m. See you there.
The original
originator. 95.
You can listen to us while you're at home doing some chores, or you can take us along for company while you're driving in your car.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire, 95BFM's news and current affairs program. Following the government announcing its plan to improve school attendance rates, I spoke to experts in the education sector about their thoughts on this proposal. First, I spoke to Professional Teaching Fellow in Education and Social Work at the University of Auckland, Dr. Brian Marsh, about what factors are responsible for low truancy rates in the past few years. Here is that interview. As someone with extensive experience in education, what are your thoughts on the government's proposal to increase school attendance?
I think any proposal to increase school attendance is an excellent idea. My concern about the specific traffic light proposal, the red, yellow, green proposal, is that I can't see that there is extra, there are plans for extra resource to be put into dealing with the students whose names will go forward to the Ministry of Education. At the moment, it seems that the red flag students' names will be put forward, but I can't see in the plan that there is resource for resolving the issue. So we're going to identify the students, but the question that sits in my head is, what are we going to do about it when we know who they are?
What issues do you believe are responsible for low attendance rates, particularly post-COVID-19?
Yeah, well, post-COVID-19 is the point, I think. One of the things that's happened in the post-COVID era, one of the things that the lockdown did, was to kind of burst the bubble around school, really. So school suddenly moved from being compulsory to an optional, maybe not kind of arrangement. We had emergency remote learning as a substitute. Our students stayed home for often quite extended periods. And I think that kind of ruptured the social contract, if you like, between students and schools. Suddenly school wasn't as compulsory as it had been. And some of those students are proving hard to get back into the classroom.
Part of the government's traffic light proposal for attendance would be fining parents. What impact do you believe this would have?
Well, I'm not sure that it's going to have very much impact at all, actually. I think what we need to do is explore whereabouts the low rates of attendance are taking place, in which schools they are taking place, and what kind of communities are experiencing this. I was reading an article written in 2022 by some of my university colleagues that was looking at the notion of students who struggle in schools when many of their classmates move on. So it was about the transient population in New Zealand schools and looking at this as a social and relationship issue for the students left behind. Now, if transients, and the article made the point that transience is more prevalent in lower socioeconomic communities, and that compared to other OECD countries, New Zealand has a very high rate of mobility in our secondary school population. Now, if that's one of the things that lies behind low rates of attendance, then the issue is kind of a social and relationship one. Kids are moving schools, probably the decision to move the school is out of their hands. They're arriving in a new environment where they have to start reintroducing themselves into the social fabric of the school, and that can be very challenging. What we know about adolescents is that their peer networks are very important to them, and when they get disrupted in any way, then that may cause the individual to withdraw. So if we've got a bundle of things that relates to socioeconomics, that relates to student and family mobility, then a fine placed in that kind of household isn't going to resolve the issue. And it's going to take resource away from households that are already possibly struggling in the current environment.
The government has set a target of 80% of students being present for more than 90% of the term by 2030. Do you think that this could be achievable?
Yes, I think it could. But the 90% per term challenge is quite high. It's interesting that an estimate of school attendance is that about 85% of our students are attending on any given day. Now that's quite a laudable figure, I think. If we're taking 90% attendance over an entire term, And terms are 10 weeks long, then a student only has to be absent due to a single illness, and possibly COVID might be one of those, or a winter flu. A student only has to be absent for more than 5 days to fall below that target. So again, I would be really keen to interrogate the figures that lie behind those overall attendance rates, and to look at how many kids are routinely in school on a day-to-day basis. The term by term measure might be sending us in the wrong direction slightly.
What measures would you recommend to the government to perhaps reduce barriers that might be preventing children from attending school?
Mm. Well, I think it's economic resource for many people. In many parts of the media, in January and February, there are quite significant column inches, or however we measure the media's contribution these days, devoted to the cost of school uniforms, about how it forms a barrier to people returning to school for the new academic year. So economic resource is a considerable can be a considerable stumbling block. I know from a colleague recently retired from a school in a low socioeconomic area in the Hawke's Bay that in the harvest season kids go missing for quite long periods of time because they are out labouring in the workforce to bring money into the household. So our view of what might cause absenteeism has to be a very broad one, and we have to be prepared to engage in quite a lot of complexity in order to resolve the issue overall, I think.
I also spoke to Senior Lecturer in Education and Social Work at the University of Auckland, Dr. John Finnerty, about how we can make school a more inclusive space that is safe for LGBTQIA+ students. Here is that interview. First of all, what are your thoughts on the government's proposal to increase school attendance?
I'm really grateful that the government is thinking about school attendance. We know that educational achievement is really important for people's well-being. It's one thing we don't actually think about, but getting a high-quality education actually improves your adult well-being. So the impacts of schools and educational achievement can't be underestimated. And what I'm also interested to see, though, is how we think about this equitably. How do we ensure that everyone is getting the benefits that should come from having good school achievement?
So we've seen recently at Buller High School in the South Island, students have said that LGBTQIA+ students are being bullied relentlessly and that they don't feel supported by their school. Could you speak to what impact bullying in particular against minority students can have on attendance?
The impact on attendance for bias-related bullying, so that's being bullied on some aspect of your personality, is significant. And that's because there's bullying that can occur for a range of factors, but when there's something that's actually about a part of your identity, that probably also means that there's aspects of the school culture and the broader culture that suggest that those elements of someone's life are not valuable, or in fact actually things that should be punished out of existence. And that means that those schools become unsafe, and obviously when people are faced with unsafe situations, it's not a big leap to think that they'll do whatever they can to avoid being unsafe. And that's where we see some of the issues around a lack of school attendance, when schools become essentially places that are dangerous. So there's sometimes critique about whether or not schools have a role to play in well-being, and we're all mindful that schools are asked to do more and more things, but schools as a mandated place for young people to go can absolutely produce negative consequences if people are being subjected to violence or intimidation, or simply being told that they're worthless, which essentially is what we might be seeing happening in that case in Buller High School.
Yeah, we've also seen discussion from the government about reforming gender and sexuality education in schools. Do you have any concerns around this?
I absolutely have major concerns around this, because essentially when we're thinking about bias-related bullying, we're thinking about bullying that is grounded in prejudices that society holds, that people hold, that make particular people targets if they sit outside of the norm. We know in Aotearoa New Zealand there is a very strong hetero norm, there's a very strong cis norm, the idea that people will have the same gender as that was ascribed to them when they were born. And because those norms are so pervasive and so destructive, if we don't have education that actually provides a tiny slither of intervention to kind of think about actually gender and sexuality exist on a spectrum. A range of identities are not only expected, but are valuable and useful. If we don't have any ability to kind of talk to the natural variation that exists in these spaces, it means that young people who occupy those identities become particularly vulnerable in schools. And the point of the relationships and sexuality education guidelines really was to provide some support for schools to start intervening in the context that produce kind of exclusionary environments for these young people. So the idea that we might remove, you know, a very thin layer of protection is really distressing, because really there's not a lot else that's there for schools, unless you're lucky enough to go to a school that is super proactive, super inclusive, and is thinking about how all members of the school community can be welcomed and can thrive. And it doesn't sound like we're seeing that particularly strongly in some schools.
And what would your message to parents be who may have concerns or may not understand the reason behind inclusive gender and sexuality education, but want to learn more so that they can support their child or so that they can understand why this needs to be taught in schools?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And parents and whānau always want to do the best for their children. And there can be a lot of moral panic. There's always been a lot of moral panic that exists around gender and sexuality in relation to children and young people, with sort of ideas that these ideas can be, or these identities can be contagious. And first of all, it's really important to make it clear that that isn't the case, that people don't simply become LGBTQIA+ because they heard about it in school. What's really important then, though, is to recognise that a sizeable proportion of young people will be. The research that we've conducted in Aotearoa New Zealand suggests that at least 1 in 10 young people will occupy one of these identities. So that's a huge proportion of the population that deserve to have a safe and equitable and thriving experience at school. So for those parents that would be concerned about this, I would ask them to think about the young people that deserve to have a positive, fair experience at school in relation to their own concerns about whether or not this is too early for children to be learning about, or there's sometimes suggestions that these topics ruin people's innocence. I think that is also about kind of starting to open up a question around why we think being LGBT is somehow innocent or bad, or not innocent and therefore bad. When we create opportunities for people to think critically about where they've developed some of these negative attitudes, often they realise that some of these beliefs aren't grounded in fact. Sometimes there's been things that have simply been handed down over generations. We live in an incredibly heteronormative, homophobic and transphobic society. I can't count the amount of times I've been on public transport where I've heard young people throwing the word gay around as a slur, even today. We've seen rainbow pride crossings being painted over. We've seen firebombing. So the idea that one little bit of inclusive education is the end of the world in a context where queer people and trans people are facing fundamental kind of sustained negativity about their identities, I think is also something that we need to question. So those will be some of my things. And then, you know, specifically, if you're looking for more support, and there's amazing support out there, Rainbow Youth has a great website, Inside Out has a great website, and there's also specific resources for people that are parenting trans and non-binary children or who are in those spaces. And all of those sites are places that will give you some helpful resources. Outline is also available for people that are wondering themselves if they may be part of these communities, or if they're supporting young people that are part of these communities too.
If students aren't getting comprehensive sex education, what information can you share about where students might be getting that information from anyway, and how accurate that might be?
Great question. And we know that from the Identify survey, where we asked 4,800 Takatāpui and Rainbow young people about their experiences getting sexuality education, overwhelming, you know, like 9 out of 10 of them say they didn't get anything decent anyway from school. This is before any repeal of any, you know, more inclusive guidelines. So the majority of the time, if we don't have teachers that are well supported and educated to deliver sexuality and relationship education, most young people, I suspect, are getting this information online. They're getting it from their peers. And that will come with some varying levels of quality as well. And so the ideal situation would be that we would have inclusive, comprehensive relationships and sexuality education that was delivered by trained teachers who were able to really lean into some of this stuff. Because expecting parents and whānau to kind of pick up the slack, so it's really difficult. You know, and often there's a lot of people's own experiences that need to be teased out in relation to some of these things. And there's no easy way to really teach about consent except by really fostering good critical thinking. And that's what schools are ideally well-suited to do. What we really want to do is see them empowered to give this the time in the curriculum that we need. Traditionally, and this government in particular, has really emphasised the importance of reading, writing and arithmetic as key skills. But it's also clear that, you know, if you want to be a productive member in society, you also need to know how to work with difference, work with people who are different to you. You also need to know how to be positive in relationship to others. So we'd also like to see, a strong emphasis on how we support young people to learn about what it means to be a good friend, how to be a good romantic partner, if that's something that they want to do. And that's stuff that I think we'd get really productive kind of use out of some decent relationships and sexuality education time in schools. I think just to really emphasise that idea that, you know, when people talk about the basics and they talk about reading, writing and arithmetic, that there is a basic before that, and that is school is safe and supportive for all students. And that's something that all school boards under our Education Act are legislated to provide. So if you're in a school where you are not safe and supportive, or if you're looking after tamariki or a young person that is not safe and supported, that is actually an issue for the school board. And that's something that I would encourage you to raise with the school board. All school boards want to do their best, but sometimes they get overwhelmed by these things, and it's easy to kind of be drawn into, you know, policy initiatives around an hour of maths and an hour of writing. But if that's happening in a context where people are being demoralised and bullied, it's not going to produce the outcomes that we want. I think also one thing that I'd like to note is that when we talk about bullying, sometimes it's easy to think about bullying as simply those kind of violent acts and being hit. But actually, bullying also includes any experiences that are designed to harm someone intentionally. And that includes when people isolate and prevent people from being part of peer groups. And what that does is it stops them being able to develop themselves as a person. And that can be hard to claim as bullying if we have this idea that bullying is only this aggressive, violent act. So I'd also encourage parents to kind of check in and see with young people about what their experiences are like, and also to legitimate those experiences of being isolated and withdrawn as important. And sometimes the research shows that actually that relational form of bullying is more likely to be associated with distress than actually the kind of physical forms, which feels counterintuitive until you think about the whole point of adolescence is to develop your identity and you develop your identity by being in relationship with others. So those would be some of my ideas, is to really listen to young people, listen to their experiences, and to legitimate the harm that's done to them if they are being bullied.
That was Dr. Brian Marsh, as well as Dr. John Finnerty from the University of Auckland Education and Social Work Faculty, on how the government can ensure students are attending school.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
A recent symposium by the National Wetland Trust has emphasised the crucial role of wetlands in carbon absorption and supporting the ecosystem. With New Zealand having lost 90% of its wetlands over the last 150 years, experts have emphasised the need for conservation and restoration efforts. I spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Waikato, David Campbell, about his recent comments regarding the climate-saving potential of New Zealand's wetlands. Here is that interview. For those who may be unaware, could you please speak on the importance of wetland conservation, particularly in its ability to sequester carbon?
Wetlands are very diverse ecosystems. Some of them are extremely good at storing large amounts of carbon over very long periods of time, such as rain-fed peat bogs, of which some parts of New Zealand have formerly had extensive areas of these sorts of wetlands, and these are often called peatlands. And once they're drained, they become quite valuable for agriculture, but unfortunately all of that carbon that was often stored over thousands of years is lost back to the atmosphere. And that is a real problem, because soils which are used for farming, which were once in these carbon-rich wetland ecosystems, are now major sources of carbon dioxide back to the atmosphere, and we estimate that between 7% and 10% of New Zealand's entire net greenhouse gas emissions come from 1% of our soils. So that's a big problem. Other sorts of wetlands, which are the sort of lowland swamps that are often seen alongside rivers, are very productive wetlands because they are nutrient rich and they're frequently inundated by floodwater, so they tend to have very rapid plant growth. So indigenous New Zealand wetlands, so what these used to look like, this is where kahikatea forest would have once been, and flax swamps, which were very important to Māori as a source of food and fibre. These sorts of wetlands have also been destroyed. They tend not to have stored a huge amount of carbon, just because they are so nutrient rich that there's a huge amount of turnover of organic matter. So a lot of the carbon would have been stored above ground in trees and other plants. The sediments would have been carbon rich, but they were not particularly deep. So very different to the peat bogs that I'm talking about, where peat could accumulate up to 10 or 15 metres depth over a few thousand years. So there are, in summary, there are very different sorts of peatlands that have different importance for carbon uptake and storage.
In your opinion, what policy changes are needed to prioritise wetland conservation in order to...
The wetlands that we have left, which is only about 10% of the wetland area that was here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, when European settlement started, those wetlands have largely gone and mostly been replaced with agricultural land. And so the 10% that remain are biologically very, very important for the sort of plants and animals that rely on wetland environments. But they also have a big function to play in improving water quality. And in fact, a lot of farmers are now recreating wetlands where they used to be in the landscape, because it's now recognised that wetlands are quite incredibly good at removing nutrients from farming activities, from water, and reducing sediment load that can get into rivers and lakes and streams. So we're now turning to wetlands as a bit of a powerhouse for improving water quality. And so we need to be careful that we protect the wetlands that we still have left that are in more or less their natural state. I'm really concerned that in the desire to continually increase agricultural production, that some of our remaining wetlands might end up being damaged or even drained. And so I have a big concern about that. There has been a range of policies over the last 10 or 20 years with the purpose of making sure that the remaining wetlands are protected. Unfortunately, they're so fragmented out in the landscape that often the edges have been nibbled away at them, or small wetlands continue to be drained or infested with pest plants and so on. And so there has been an ongoing loss of wetlands over the last 10 or 20 years. And I'm really worried that we will continue to lose wetlands.
I also spoke to senior ecologist at Manaki Whenua, Olivia Burge, about the potential of climate change restoration through wetland conservation. Here is the interview.
How have the risks and opportunities in wetland conservation evolved over time?
So in terms of the, I guess, the opportunities for wetland conservation, it's always a good time to start. So New Zealand's lost 90% of its wetlands, the estimate of pre-human wetland extent in New Zealand. What that means is that there is a large area around us, in our cities, on our farms, that can be restored, that was once wetland, and plenty of those areas will be suitable for restoring. Can it go wrong? I mean, yes, it can. We know, for example, we have invasive weeds in wetlands, so you may find in a wetland restoration that there isn't enough resources, for example, to reduce weed infestation. You may end up with vegetation you did not want to have there. That might include, for example, willows. There's quite a bit of willow invasion in some wetlands in New Zealand. Overall, though, I think the most people who I've spoken to have undertaken wetland restoration on their own land are pretty happy with the results and even surprised about how good it has been.
How do you envision the future of wetland conservation considering the current trajectory of land use and climate change?
I think we have to acknowledge that we are continuing to lose wetlands in this country, in New Zealand, and that's a bad thing both for climate change and also mitigating the effects of climate change, such as those large storm events. We need more wetlands to mitigate those, not less. I think there's been some positive change recently in terms of the introduction of the National Policy Statement Freshwater Management, and that's been focused on mapping our wetlands, and that's critical because we can't monitor and look after what we don't know exists. And also looking after our wetlands. So the National Wetland Trust has done some work on why we've been continuing to lose wetlands, even though in kind of modern times we don't go out in wholesale clear forests and we don't go out in wholesale clear wetlands, but we are still continuing to lose them. And some of the issues that was caused by is inconsistent strength of regional plans or implementation and enforcement of rules and regional plans relating to wetland loss. So that's critical. I think it's also a matter of education and getting folks to understand the benefit, like the personal benefits that you can get from having a healthy wetland on your property, while acknowledging the economic pressures on farmers, for example, with like high debt leveraging, for example, on dairy farms, and how do we encourage that? So I think part of that is education and support for the folks who are really keen to make a positive difference. And then part of that is rules and regulations, which mean that we don't have just a small minority of folks letting people down. Thinking, I guess, more specifically around peatlands, so there's been quite a lot of talk around peatlands in New Zealand. The drained peatlands, both in New Zealand and overseas, are really large emitters of CO2. So the drained peatlands add up to about 6% of our agricultural emissions, and the Climate Change Commission has said that this is one of the biggest emission sources that are not in the ETS. So if you get some farmers, for example, would like wetlands to be in the NPS because then they get the credit, you know, the credit of restoring wetlands on their property. And that's great. But if we include the positive impacts of wetlands in the NPS, we also need to account for the really quite large impacts that drained peatlands are having on our greenhouse gas emissions and the status of those. And that's a particular area in the Waikato. And that's where, for example, we may need to think about a transition from current farming to maybe novel land use practices. So these emissions, these carbon emissions from drained peatlands, we can stop those by re-wetting the peatlands.
That was Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, David Campbell, and Senior Ecologist at Manukai Whenua, Olivia Birch.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Small Business Trade Jobs NZ is facing a legal dispute with TradeMe over its name and branding. TradeMe Jobs is claiming copyright infringement for using the word trade and jobs. TradeMe told 95BFM they cannot go into the details of the case while it is before the court, but they provided us with the following statement. We have used the name TradeMe Jobs since 2006. It's an important part of our business. We've worked hard to build a distinctive brand that is recognised and trusted by Kiwis. We really take the decision to go to court, and we don't take the decision lightly. It is something we would only consider as a last resort. I spoke to Trade Jobs NZ owner Colleen Gitley about their business, Trade Jobs NZ, and their opposition to TradeMe's claim. First of all, can you tell our listeners about Trade Jobs NZ?
Yes. So Trade Jobs NZ is, just as the name suggests, we're a job site for the trades industry in New Zealand. We launched in 2021 when we were in second lockdown, actually. My son-in-law got made redundant and he was in the trades. I have a long background in recruitment and he just said to me when he was looking for a job, Colleen, there just isn't a specific niche job site for the trades in New Zealand. And we discussed as a family the unique needs of trades and tradies. I can go on a longer explanation about the building and how we've created something that is very unique and different. But that's the initial light bulb moment and how Trade Jobs NZ started. So we're a job site specifically for the trades and the trades industry in New Zealand.
Can you go into a little bit about what TradeMe is actually claiming in its legal action against you?
Yeah, sure. So, quite simply, I can tell you that the story of it. But there are three things. One is the use of our colour orange, and two, the use of the words trade and jobs. So initially, they approached us about 6 months after we launched and said, hey, look, we don't like you using the colour orange. We had no idea that they owned colour orange. From our perspective, TradeMe have a huge number of different colours. And to be honest, I think your listeners would agree with me that TradeMe is yellow and blue. We chose orange because it's high vis, synonymous with the trades. When we went through our whole process of identifying our brand identity, brand and our brand guidelines, orange, high-vis orange is the colour of the trade, hence the reason we chose it. We went back after them sending us a cease and desist letter to our support email address, which my university student, I have to say, was part-time, received. And alerted me to it. But we went back to them and said no, and that, no, we're not changing our colour orange, and this is the reason why we've changed it quite lightly. And we thought, okay, that's the end of it. But 6 months later, they came back and said, no, we actually now don't like you using the words trade and jobs, believing that they have, essentially believing they have ownership of those words, combined with the colour orange. And we were absolutely flabbergasted because trade jobs, what we do is specifically for the trades, and we assist trade businesses and trade candidates to get jobs. So we obviously went back and said, no, we're sticking to who we are and what we do, and then the name just simply describes what we do. Then they, about 6 months later, they hit us with going to the High Court, suing us for passing off for trademark infringement and suing for the use of the orange and trade and jobs, and also suing both myself and my husband personally. And this is where we are at now.
Yeah, and do you think it's fear that a consumer might confuse your business with Trade Me Jobs?
I think if you... But number one, I'm not confused. Number two, our employer clients, our client base are not confused. So if you understand what we do, if you go to our job site, your website, you'll be, it's very, very clear what we do. So we launched the site specifically, as I say, to address a niche part of the market. So that niche part of the market was retail, or was it health? It would be the same thing. Quite simple, trade jobs in New Zealand. In fact, what we did do, Jess, before we launched, we did a survey asking, and it went out over social media, which is how we actually work. So what we do is we, when our clients come to us with a job in the trades, we work with them and write a job ad for them, and then we work with them to promote that job over social media, so that we're essentially shoulder tapping the tradie that's actually out there working. So when we did our initial survey around how trade people found jobs, we found that 80% of them were word of mouth. We found that a lot of people that are working in the jobs wanted to change, but weren't in front of a computer. So how could we tap them on the shoulder to apply for a job? And we came up with a methodology, which was using Meta, using social media algorithms to promote those jobs out to them. So we use that same methodology to do our research. We targeted over social media tradies and trade employers and asked them if there was a job site for the trades in New Zealand, would you use it? Now that was 790 responses, which is pretty high, very high response. 91% said yes. So when we asked the question, if there was a job site for the trades in New Zealand, would you use it? Great. That was like the stamp to say, we need to go ahead and do this. That's why we called our site Trade Jobs NZ.
And just lastly, what are your next steps in this dispute?
Our next steps is to continue to fight this, because we know we're not in the wrong. We have never tried to pass off or pretend or insinuate that we are Trade Me. Again, I say to your listeners, if you go onto our site, if you register as an employer, it's quite obvious what we do. There's quite a few steps, and you also get a phone call. Same as when you go on as a tradie looking for a job, where you start to input all the information, and again, you get contacted again. So the other reason why I'm incensed about this is because trade and jobs are generic English names. So a large investment firm owns TradeMe. They've got money to burn. So they're coming in and they're saying essentially that they own the words trade and jobs and a colour. That is like, it's beyond belief, right? So if we don't fight this, what happens to somebody else? Because it's going to happen to somebody else.
That was Trade Jobs NZ owner Colleen Jetley about their business's opposition to TradeMe's legal claim against them.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa, mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Jules filling in for Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.